College with Chris Graham.
Welcome to the podcast, Chris Graham and Scott German. We're going to talk some UVA sports. We'll finish with basketball. Scott covered the intra-squad scrimmage on Saturday, and we'd love to get some of Scott's impressions of the new-look defending champion UVA basketball team. We got to start with football. And, Scott, we haven't talked since the game Friday night. The defense looked great, 265 yards, 17 points. Most situations you go into that kind of a game with that kind of a defensive effort, you win the game. Offense has the ball inside the Miami 30 six times out of 10 possessions, only scores 9 points, three field goals on those six trips inside the 30, and UVA loses the game 17-9. So wanted to get your first impressions. We were texting back and forth during the game on Friday night. Wanted to get your impressions for the podcast here of the game Friday night.
Well, obviously, you know, very disappointing because we thought we would go down there and pick up a win, even though Las Vegas evidently knew what was what, because they had us as a slight underdog. But I still felt like we were by far the better team. So it's disappointing we go and we don't play a really strong game. And again, some of our weaknesses, some of our deficiencies on offense are being exploited, mainly the offensive line. And of course, completely dominating the loss was the fact that we lost Bryce Hall for the season. You and I know what a great kid he is, Chris, because we spent time with him at the Operation Football kickoff back in July. And you really feel bad about that. And I know you and I had an ongoing debate during the game about whether he should have been out there or not. You know, hopefully touch on that again. I've kind of been on both sides of the pendulum there, but I'm back to squarely being on the side that I just can't see the risk-reward factor being favoring him being out there on that play. So, yeah, but, you know, disappointed that we lost him for the season. I hope that he's okay. I hope he can come back, be ready for the NFL workouts. But you know, they've got a lot of work to do, and I think you know, Mendenhall and staff are going to really have to put some effort into figuring out what's going on with the offensive line or when the rest of the season could be very hard to come by, because let's face it, Miami was not a very good football team.
Not a very good football team, but a very, very good defense. Second best defense in the ACC statistically, only behind Clemson and just ahead of Virginia. So don't the record – I've said this going into the game. I actually wrote this going into the game. Records, you know, can be deceiving at times. I know that there is that theory advanced by Bill Parcells and Al Groh, and that's how we kind of follow it. You are what your record says you are, but the reason that Vegas had Miami a slight favorite at home was because they were just a couple plays away from being a 5-0 team. And the one issue that Miami had going in was offense turnovers. And when you take the turnovers away, you have a chance to win games, and they didn't turn the ball over Friday night. But defensively, Miami is as good as anybody in the country, a top 15 defense nationally. And so that said, I want to revisit the Bryce Hall issue in a moment. But since we're talking offense, let's talk offense. You might be surprised to hear this, Scott, because you and I text all the time. Our listeners out there don't get to they're not privy to our text back and forth. So I don't know if you've looked at the website in the last, say, 24 hours or so. But if you haven't, you will be surprised to hear me say I wrote a column about this time yesterday, Sunday, saying that I think that Bronco Mendenhall needs to make a change at offensive coordinator, and that Robert Anae should be at the least stripped of his play calling duties and maybe go with Jason Beck, maybe go with Marcus Hagans, two guys who could call plays for you. But my thinking is at this stage, we're six games into the season. Virginia has the 13th best offense in the ACC, only better than Georgia Tech, which is going through that massive transition from option to spread. And if this team is going to have any chance of winning the Coastal Division in the second half of the season, there needs to be someone different calling plays on offense. So first off, Scott, are you surprised to hear me say that? And second off, your thoughts?
I am, because if you were at the end of the bus as far as being on the bandwagon.
Not an A bandwagon, just not fire him, but yeah.
The logic that it didn't make sense to change in the middle of the season.
Yeah.
Maybe. I'm you know, I am a little surprised because usually you're a little more stick to it this than that. But I think you also know football well enough to know that this thing is broken offensively. And, Chris, you know, I had a conversation. I've had a lifelong, lifetime friendship, well, not lifetime, but since he played in UVA back in the 80s, was the offensive line that actually made first team all ACC senior year, offensive guard under George Wells, Mike Battle. And Mike and I spoke yesterday, and Mike's still very much a supporter of the program, follows him everywhere. He said, Dana, really? He didn't understand. He's not, you know, never kept up as far as the coach or anything. One in the private business, doing very well as an agent, sports agent, out in the Richmond area. He said the thing that surprised him the most was the lack of any changes as far as blocking schemes, as far as things that were being done with Perkins out of time, huddles and things. The one thing he pointed out to me is when they had the young offensive line at Virginia, and Mike was one of the upper class, and then he had surrounded by freshmen and sophomores, they often held the quarterback, and it was Sean Moore. They actually, a lot of times, kept him under center because Mike, it's a lot easier to hold your block for 1 or 2 seconds than it is when the quarterback is running out of shotgun. So, you know, we didn't really see a lot of that switching around. I don't know if that's really, I mean, I'm sure, you know, I'm not doubting Mike Battle's word for it because Mike played the game at a very high level. So I don't know if that's part of the problem, that we're not really reacting to what's going on out there. But, you know, some of the play calls, just even to someone like me, an armchair quarterback, just didn't make sense. 4th and 1, and you got your quarterback out of the shotgun. Things like that just kind of leave my head scratching. And maybe I'm wondering if we're overcomplicating things, and it's time to just go back to just real basic offensive schemes.
Well, you know, I'll throw a couple of thoughts out there too. You know, a key difference between going under center versus shotgun. I think it probably actually. I mean, to a degree, it could be a little easier to block in the shotgun than it would be under center because you do have to block for a second or two longer to let the quarterback get back into the backfield, his 5-step drop, 7-step drop to get back there. Whereas you, when the shotgun, you already have that little bit of a head start. But also, you know, it to me is more than necessarily shotgun versus under center, because if you're under center too, you have to, the defense has to account for things a little differently. You have to account for potential handoffs. It does give you the option to do a little bit more in terms of play action. You know, you can fake a handoff and a read option out of a shotgun, but you know, if you're faking a handoff to a running back who either might counter Trey or just go straight up off tackle, go straight up to the gut with a dive, you know, it keeps the linebackers and secondary, you know, for just a split second longer looking back in the backfield. So that gives you some more advantages. Of course, the disadvantage is you have to block the front four a little bit more. But but one advantage if you go that route, a problem with changing philosophies midseason is schematically you sort of are what you are. You know, you've got your five linemen, you've got your personnel units, you know, your tight ends, whatever else. You know, if you were to, you can't just change from a spread offense necessarily very easily to a more pro style offense, especially because we don't have an off week. If we'd have done something, during the off week, but the bye week before Miami, there's a little bit more time to maybe implement some different philosophies into things. But I guess an issue I've got with the way the offense is going right now is it's broken. And it's not just the last two games. We're looking at the last two games because Virginia lost the last two games. But I don't know that the offense has really been purring really all season long. I mean, even the Pittsburgh game, the win at Pittsburgh, that was a great defensive effort, a sort of average offensive effort. And, you know, you've seen it since. I don't think the offense was overly impressive in the William & Mary win. And that was, you know, that was the William & Mary game. So what I'd say is you know, you look at results, you look at productivity or lack thereof, and you say, what can we do differently? And I guess what I'm most disappointed by, Scott, and for our listeners out there, I'm most disappointed that after the bye week, you know, we saw what our flaws were after Notre Dame. The flaws were we can't block a really good defensive front four. Miami's got a really good defensive front four. That team on defense has a lot of NFL guys. The offense is suspect, but that defense for Miami's pretty good. I told you, they're a top 15 defense nationally. And so between Notre Dame and Miami, I was expecting to see something different, something schematically different, something in terms of different patterns of play calls, and you didn't see anything different. You saw the same tired offense that you saw for the first five games. And what that tells me is you're going to see the same tired offense for the last six games. If we're not going to change bye week after being exposed by Notre Dame, you're not going to change now when you don't have bye weeks and you've got some good defenses coming up. Duke's got a really good defense. Don't just because they're Duke, don't say that they're not a good football team. That Duke defense is really good. David Cutcliffe thinks this might be the best defense he's ever had there. He's had some pretty good teams in recent years. So this could be another situation where you could be playing uphill against a team, and all of a sudden this championship level team we thought we had could be 4-3 after this weekend if we don't play it right. I just look at it and say, Scott, if nothing's going to change with a current guy, you got to do something different. And, doing something different might be a different guy calling the plays.
Yeah, that could be. I don't know if any of us really know the what's going through the thought process of Bendit Hall, but, he and they are very close. They've worked together for many, many years. So if that's going to be something that if it's going to happen, I kind of doubt it's going to happen during the season. I think it may happen during the off season, as far as maybe he retires or does something differently within the organization. I think a lot of us, including myself, just don't completely understand to the extent the injuries that the team has had across the front. Only one of them maybe season ending, and I think that was not sure when that happened, but even when you have a player injured out for a few plays or out for a game, it does affect the continuity by causing guys to have to move around a lot. Mike, I told you the conversation I had with Mike Battle, guard for Virginia in the late 80s, mid 90s, he did allude that offensive line play in the modern era is totally different. The modern era being 2020 as compared to 30 years ago. It's no longer a bunch of just big blockheads. It takes a smart group of players that have to work together continuously, cohesively. That's what you're looking for. The junior, you have a lot of juniors and seniors on that offensive line, and that's just not the case right now. But maybe Bendit Hall knows that offensive play calling, we're kind of do that. Limit the playbook, hanging behind your back, whatever. But you just expect to be, this is your fourth year, and you expect that there could have been some depth developed by now.
Well, and I've been making that argument. I mean, I've been defending the offensive play to this point this year. You looked at the two deep for last week's game for Miami, the Miami game. A two deep would have 10 guys theoretically on your five offensive line positions. Two guys for each position. Actually, there were 9 guys because Dylan Rinkensmeyer was listed at 2 positions. He was listed as a starter. I believe it was right tackle and then backup at center. I think I have that right. One of the tackle positions anyway. He was a starter. And of that group, only 2 were juniors, and the other 7 were either true freshmen, redshirt freshmen, or sophomores. That's a young team. You've got to have guys who are in the program for a while. They can develop the smarts. They can develop the physical part of it. You got to be big. You got to be in the weight room for 3 or 4 years at the college level. We've got 2 4-star recruits at offensive line from the class of 2019 who aren't even playing. They're redshirting because it's best, you have to start wondering, would you rather have them in their first season or their redshirt senior season? When they're in 4 years, when they're 23 years old, would you rather have them blocking then as opposed to now? Four years into a weight program versus a couple months into a weight program. So, those are decisions you make roster-wise for the long-term future, and those are probably smart decisions. But all that said, Robert Anae has been a college football coach, an assistant coach his entire career, 28 years. 14 of those years, he was the offensive line coach somewhere. If anybody should be fixing the offensive line, it should be him. And the fact that we can't figure this out, and I'm not talking about just coaching your offensive line better. He's not the offensive line position coach, but he's got the background. 14 of his 28 years, he was an offensive line coach. He should know how to scheme a little differently. And if you don't have the guys to block, you know, maybe you got to do some different things. You got to have a tight end stay in. You have to have a running back, and you got to chip guys. You know, you got to do some different things. But whatever the case may be, you've got to do some different things. And they're not doing different things. They're doing the same things. And it's frustrating to see a guy like Bryce Perkins, who averaged 71 yards a game rushing last year, averaging 31 yards a game this year, not able to – I mean, we're not even running anything creative for him. He's basically – when he's taking snaps and doing the design runs that we saw last year you saw him getting on the perimeter. You saw him doing some different things. This year, it's pretty much a wildcat play. You're snapping a ball to him, and he's just running behind the line and seeing if he can find a hole, and he's not finding holes. We've got weapons, and this is another frustrating thing. You've got Joe Reed. You've got Hassise Dubois. You've got Tavares Kelly. You've got guys out there that if you get the ball to them in space, they can do something with it. We're not getting them the ball. So it's frustrating to see that you've got, four of the elite players at skill position in the ACC with Perkins, with Joe Reed, with Tavares Kelly, with Hassise Dubois, and you're 13th in the ACC in offense. It's frustrating to see that, and it's frustrating to see the defense playing as well as it is, and you're 4-2. And I look at the schedule now, and I look at Duke is solid. Carolina played Clemson tough. Louisville just beat Wake Forest. You've got games against those guys. You got a Virginia Tech team that beat Miami, a team that we just lost to. So, you know, all of a sudden, a season that looked like a 9-3 or 10-2 season could easily turn into a 6-6 or 7-5 season if you don't fix the offense. Now, all this said, Scott, we're talking about this. Nothing's going to happen. I'm waiting for the transcript of the press conference to come in. As we're recording this, it's 2:20 p.m. The press conference probably ended about a half hour ago. There's not going to be any breaking news. They're not going to make a change. We're discussing this. The fan base is discussing this. The message boards are hot with this. Nothing's going to change. And we're going to continue doing what we're doing. I just wanted to go on the record and say, to me, a change needs to be made. And if we're going to live up to what Bronco has to say, which he says the mantra of this program is earned, not given. If you're going to earn something, it's not just the players. Not just the players out there who are having to earn their numbers through conditioning and everything else. It should be the coaches have to earn some things, too. It doesn't feel to me that he's earning anything right now, he being Robert Anae.
No, he's not. Anyone expecting that, it's just not going to happen. But it is kind of, to steal some of your thunder from your article, it is kind of insane to think that if you keep doing the same thing and you have different results, better results, you didn't score a touchdown. I mean, not one touchdown. And you've got to be, we do have talented players offensively. You make adjustments. I mean, these guys, these are not armchair quarterbacks. These are guys that are experienced, and then college, like you said, and it's been 28 years. You've got talented receivers. You've got to be able to offset a little bit and come up with different schemes that can get Perkins maybe getting a little more time, maybe pulling out, get the ball into the hands of these guys. It's got to be frustrating for your receivers too to kind of be underutilized like this, especially underutilized when they are your main, they should be your main options right now in the lack of a almost completely lacking a running game.
Yeah, and I would ask our listeners too, or advise our listeners. I wrote a column about Kurt Binkert had a series of thoughts he offered on Twitter both after the game Friday night and then he about 12 hours later, maybe around noon on Saturday, offered some thoughts, observations. He's on injured reserve this year with the Falcons. He was going to be their backup, and then he got injured in preseason, and he's sitting out this year. And he noted that he's watching more football than he's ever watched in his life because he's injured and he's not able to, you know, to play, game plan, etc. And he offered a lot of good thoughts, actually, about the UVA offense. And, of course, he's a guy who played in it for a couple of years under Robert and I. So I, without rehashing everything I wrote in that article, I would advise folks to maybe dial that up on the Augusta Free Press website, too. Really interesting to kind of dive into someone's mind. Again, like you said, Scott, with Mike Battle, Kurt Binkert, a guy that can offer some different insight, certainly. So let's go back then, Scott, to the – Bryce Hall situation. Of course, it's not official yet, but we know it's about as official as it needs to be that he's out for the season. And he got injured on a special teams play, second quarter blocking on a punt return. And you and I had a nice discussion. It was actually, I don't look at message boards much, but you said look at the message boards, and I did. And it is interesting to see that there is a really divergent set of opinions on this, pro and con, as to the value of having a guy like that on the field. And my position has been pretty clear. He's been on the field for the last two seasons in this role, and nobody had a problem until he got hurt. But there is the other side, which is, why do you have your best player out there on special teams, especially in a blocking capacity? So there are two sides of the argument, but you know, he's out, and that's the thing. I don't know that anybody would have even noticed. Even when he was the guy who recovered that onside kick against Notre Dame, actually. So he was on the field for special teams then too. But yeah, there is a raging debate about this, and you've been sort of, Scott, as you mentioned, you kind of have gone back and forth, but you were pretty strong on the other side of this. So give your thoughts on the Bryce Hall.
I have. I've kind of flipped back and forth, but I'm back to my original opinion, is that he had no business being out there. And here, I may, you know, and I checked him back and forth. I said, that's all, I would make a horrible coach. You know, but very much live my life conservatively, except in politics. But I look at things more evaluating the risk reward factor. So if you take that play, and I'm certainly would be open to someone coming up with something different than that, but if you take that play, what is the, how is anyone, people like the reward of having Bryce Hall out there on a turn team, where to me his primary objective is to block? What is the, how does that risk reward favor the reward as far as what happened? And it was a free play. It wasn't someone, you know, a kamikaze player on the other team came and waylaid him. You know, it was just basically a brief play that he got injured. But that's what I'm saying. Those things can happen. And how does the reward outweigh the risk in a situation like that? What could he have done that would have turned that play successful? Was the objective to have him out there that the punter sure would break it for a touchdown, maybe go 30, 40 yards? What's, a lot of times your big call on return thing is just not to fumble the darn ball. So, and we've had that happen many times, especially under Coach Blunden. I'm just looking at it from that standpoint. I just did not see the reward outweighing the risk. And to be honest, maybe I'm not paying close enough attention, but I was not aware that he was out there. I think I knew he was on the kickoff return team, but I did not know he was regularly playing on the punt return team.
Yeah, actually, according to, and this is from Brad Franklin at Cavs Corner, so this is not an original number for me. I'm someone who looks at the player participation charts every game. They don't break down how many plays you play, just that you play on certain units. But from Brad Franklin, and this is actually, so he's sharing information from Pro Football Focus college data. There are people who count up how many plays you play at different positions, everything else. And according to Pro Football Focus, that was the 133rd time he was in on a punt return in his career, 62 career snaps on kick coverage, 19 on kick return. So that's 214 plays on either kick return or kick coverage in his career. Never returned a punt. So despite the speed, you know, you'd think, hey, you got game-breaking speed using him at returner. But so 214 plays in his career on kick with the kick units and not as a returner. So no, not even close to the first time he was out there. And it wasn't that they snuck him in for the Notre Dame special teams play where he recovered the onside kick. That wasn't a sneak play either. I mean, he's been out there. 214 plays signifies consistency. I would argue that people who are saying that special teams are somehow diminished, like a lesser unit or something like that, there are three phases of the game. Offense, defense, special teams is the other phase. You can win or lose games on special teams. Virginia, with everything that went wrong, on Friday night, after the Miami field goal that made it 10-6 in the fourth quarter, Joe Reed broke a long kickoff return and got stopped by the kicker at about the 25-yard line of Miami. If the kicker doesn't make the stop, Reed goes in and scores, and who knows, Virginia might win the game with a kick return. Now, of course, Joe Reed's also a starter. Joe Reed is, and nobody's complaining about Joe Reed playing. If you want to be consistent, you got to say Bryce Hall shouldn't play special teams. Joe Reed shouldn't play special teams. And Joe Reed is arguably, I mean, I don't even know arguably. Well, he's either your first or second best offensive player, which makes him the second or third best player in your team going into to the game the other night. You've got to have guys on special teams who are good. You've got to have talented guys out there. You can't just put reserves in the game as special teams. There are teams who do that, but I don't know that Virginia is at a phase now where there's enough talent among your 85 scholarship players that you can say we can get away with putting our 45th through 62nd best players on special teams. You know, your two deep is your starters and your backups at all 11 offensive positions, all 11 defensive positions. So that's 44 guys. You can't put your 45th through whatever players and say they're the guys rushing the quarter, rushing the punter, or blocking on kicks, and et cetera, et cetera. You've got to put some athletes out there, and we have, and we're not the only team who does that. Frank Beamer, for close to 30 years, won football games at Virginia Tech by putting his best athletes out there on the field on special teams. And so that all said, I mean, that's the argument. I mean, that's the other side of the argument, I guess. And, you know, I think it holds water. I mean, we're not talking about this if he doesn't get hurt. And so and we didn't talk about it for the other 214 plays he played on special teams. And, you know, we're not complaining about Joe Reed being out there. We need Joe Reed out there. We need guys out there to do what they're doing. And unfortunately, I mean, it's a terrible situation. And I just looked, one of the guys, Damon Dillman, actually from CBS 19, he was covering the press conference today. We haven't gotten the official word yet from UVA in terms of a press release, but Bryce Hall's had surgeries out for the season. So that is about as official as you need to be. We knew that before we started talking about this. So, but yeah, that is the other side of this. Special teams plays are just as important, as defense plays, as offense plays. And it's, you know, you can't throw those plays away. And it sucks that he got hurt. But, you know, I, as you know, Scott, when we were texting the other night, I was as much as it's awful that Virginia now has to play the rest of the season without Bryce Hall, he's in the game for a reason. And I think it's a good reason.
Yeah, I guess at this point in the program with Underman and all the depth is just, you know, we know about the lack of depth offensively on the line. I guess just overall, the depth is just not there where you could basically have 8, 9, 10 players that do nothing but play special teams. So, I'm just devastated for the fact that he's such a great young man. I hope he is able to recover and be ready to go when, you know, the NFL combines come around, and he starts showcasing talents for the draft. So,
yeah,
it's tough to make, you know, someone the next man up mentality.
That's the focus now for him. And I don't want to say there's any good news when you have an injury like he had. It seems like it was a broken bone. And so anybody who's had experience with injuries, if it's a ligament, they're actually worse. I am someone who's lived through a ACL injury. I actually tore 3 ligaments in my knee playing sports in high school. And so that can take a long time to come back from. It can be something you don't come back from and play at the same high level. Broken bones, generally speaking, and I'm not, you know, I'm going to be Dr. D-Duck here and offer some expert opinion as a licensed medical physician, surgeon, etc. But broken bones generally can be the kind that can be more recovery, more likely to be close to 100% or 100% recovery. So yeah, we certainly hope for the best for Bryce Hall there. Hey, let's switch gears here, Scott, and talk basketball. You were able to be there for the inter-squad scrimmage on Saturday. The new look defending national champion Virginia basketball team, and I'm especially interested to hear from what I've heard. I've seen a few clips, but a couple of the stars of our scrimmage, Mamadi Diakite, Jay Huff in particular, apparently they looked really good. I want to hear your thoughts about those guys and the rest of the guys out there from Saturday scrimmage.
Well, they did. Both big guys, Diakite and Huff, looked polished. They looked like they really went to work over this offseason. And you know, I'm thinking about Mamadi, we know what a bright kid he is. And you can just see that he took that criticism, or he took that evaluation that he got, that he was not ready to be a draft pick in the NBA draft. He went back and worked on that, because he is, at least on Saturday, he displayed a lot of versatility. He was comfortable out on the perimeter. I think he knocked down at least one, three, maybe two. And he also looked strong inside, both offensively and defensively. Huff, same thing. Huff looks stronger, Chris. He looks like, I'm telling you, he could have a monster year because they're going to play big a lot. And no one's going to push Jay Huff around. And the fact that he can come out and be an offensive threat, I don't think we've seen that. We certainly haven't seen it. I don't know when the last time the ACC has had that type of player that is so versatile that he can go underneath, post up, and then come out and, you know, hit a knockdown of three-pointer. Both of them really impressed me. And I was also extremely impressed, kind of by a sleeper, Cody Stabnis. You know, we got to see him play last year. If you think about it, both of his playing time came in situations when the game was primarily out of reach, out of garbage time, whatever you want to call it. He didn't get a chance to really go out and play with the A guys. And he was on the floor with the A guys Saturday, and he looked extremely comfortable. He moved well without the ball. He held his own defensively, knocked down the shot when he had it. I think people have maybe followed, at least me, fell asleep on him last week. Kind of got lost in the shuffle. I think you're going to see a lot out of him this year.
Yeah, Statman averaged 10.3 points and shot 46.5% from the field in the FIBA U19 Championships World Cup this year. And so, you know, you're hoping to see that translate to UVA this year. You know, it's easy for a guy like that to be plays guard. He's a big guard, 6'7 guard. But it's easy to fall behind when there's three guys ahead of you playing in the backcourt who are all in the NBA now. But, yeah, that's exciting to hear that he stepped up the way he did. Francisco Cuffaro, you said I'm looking at your assessment from Saturday. He was of little threat offensively, but he looked like from your reading, it seemed like he played pretty well in the post. Particularly, it seemed like he matched up an awful lot with Huff in the game.
He did, and he held his own. It was a battle. Those two went at each other numerous times, and it was, man, what a sight to see two 7-footers going up against each other on the same team too. Don't want to forget that. Don't know how much they'll be in the game together, but, you know, he looks like he's going to be able to be counted upon to play Jay Huff-like minutes. You know, maybe the Jay Huff of last year, certainly capable of giving the team that, and I think that would be a huge up. He looked comfortable. He was not, you know, he didn't get intimidated again. He was playing a lot with some of the you know, first team players at times. You know, Huff was out there. I think Farr was playing against Huff and Diakite were together. You know, it's kind of unusual how he had the squad split. But I think Farr is going to be the Jay Huff, the version of Jay Huff that we saw last year and the year before. He's going to give us some minutes. He's going to be able to give Jay and Diakite at times some buzz, and that's going to be huge too.
Tomas Woldetensai, from your read, seems like he maybe didn't have a great offensive game, handled the ball well. What was your read on him in his first appearance in a Cavalier uniform?
I think if there was any player that I thought was a little bit intimidated playing, you know, he probably played in front of more fans at the Orange Blue scrimmage that he had ever played in front of him in college, if you think about it. I mean, they had probably 6,000-7,000 people there. I doubt that they had 1,000 people at most of those JUCO games that he played at. So in getting, you know, knowing a lot of eyes were on him, understandable if he was a little nervous, but he watched as much basketball as I have, as you have. You try to get a sense of players that you feel like will eventually be comfortable enough to contribute, and he did. He looked like he missed some shots that you know are going to fall. He's a prolific shooter in the junior college ranks. Those shooters are going to shoot, and they're going to miss some. I think eventually, once the rhythm of the offense, the flow, the ebb and flow of who's going to get playing minutes, how they're going to be utilized. I think he's going to be a contributor. I really do. I'm not sure how much, you know, or what capacity, but I think Tony will figure out how to best utilize him this year. You know, speaking of Coach Bennett, he looked so relaxed Saturday. Chris, you know, in a ways, it looked like he was just in his little spot, his zone, because he was really coaching. He was coaching. He was primarily on one bench, but you could tell he was coaching both teams. And he looked so relaxed. He looked so happy at being out there and being in a position that he had a bunch of players that were going to really need some tutoring, some coaching. I hadn't seen him. I think he wasn't having fun last year, but he's having fun in a completely different capacity this season.
You know, one thing I'll throw out to you, Scott, I want to get your impression on this. I saw a couple clips, maybe a total of about 4 minutes of game action from a couple of clips on YouTube. What stood out to me, I mean, because I wasn't looking for, you know, player evaluation because they were limited clips, but what I thought was most interesting, anybody who's ever been to an inter-squad scrimmage from any school in the past, you see mainly, I mean, these are just alley-oop fest. People shooting wild threes. They're exhibition games, and they're just it's just playground basketball. That's what I was getting ready to say. We were running the offense. We were running the ball continuity offense. We were running the mover blocker offense. What does that say about this team that in an exhibition game like this, a scrimmage game like this, they're still playing at a high level like that?
That is an image of a mirror of the coach, because I'm sure that's the way they practice. This was a practice that fortunately 7,000 people had access to. I'm sure this is the way it goes in every practice, because it was the intensity was there. Both teams. There wasn't a bunch of wild shooting. You know, it looked like they could have taken the court and been ready to play Syracuse University on Saturday.
That's interesting. Yeah, that does sound like a Virginia basketball team, and that's one thing we can hold our hats on. Well, Scott, I want to thank you for your time on the podcast here. We'll get you back on this week, and we'll preview UVA Duke. But thanks for your time today.
Thank you.